I'm J.G. Michael, and this is Parallax Views.
Parallax is you observe an object, you see a change, but that change is not really a change in the object, but just a change in how you relate to the object in your perspective of the object.
Welcome to the testing room of the Parallax Corporation's Division of Human Engineering.
Now please cross the chair. And you will sit down. Make yourself comfortable. And be sure to place each one of your hands on the box on either side of the chair. Making sure that each one of your fingers is on one of the white rectangles. Just sit back. Nothing is required of you except to observe the materials that are presented to you. Be sure to keep your fingers on the box at all times. Alright? Hope you find the test a pleasant experience.
On this edition of Parallax Views, Colibre Ter Sonnenblum, author of Road Tripping at the End of the World, joins us to discuss politics, activism, environmentalism, and the Greta Thunberg phenomena at just 16 years old. The young Greta Thunberg has become a sensation thanks to her efforts attempting to galvanize the world about climate change and the crisis it represents. Her activism has faced heavy attacks from the right wing, who believe her to be a pawn of a globalist conspiracy funded by George Soros. Likewise, there has been some voices on the left who have been, at the very least, critical of the non-governmental organizations and tech startups attached to the Thunberg phenomena. Chief among them is the investigative journalist Cory Morning Star, who proved particularly scathing of the Greta Thunberg phenomena in her report, The Manufacturing of Greta Thunberg for Consent, the Political Economy of the Nonprofit Industrial Complex. Whereas the right argues Thunberg is a puppet of a globalist conspiracy to push a climate change hoax, activists and journalists like Cory Morningstar believe the nonprofits attached to the Greta Thunberg phenomena do not sufficiently challenge the status quo enough to bring about the change necessary to address the climate emergency. Our guest on this edition of Parallax Views, Colibre Ter Sonnenblum, recently addressed these criticisms in a piece for our friends at Counterpunch entitled The Teachable Moment of the Greta Thunberg Phenomena. Now, as a full disclosure, before we dive into the conversation, I myself have a rather positive view of what Greta Thunberg is doing in the world today. However, Parallax Views is not one to shy away from the provocative, and I myself do believe there is a debate to be had about how NGOs want to address the climate crisis. With that being said, why not jump right into the conversation with Colibre Ter Sonnenblum? Welcome to Parallax Views, Colibri Ter Sonnenblum. How are you doing today?
I'm doing great, JG. Thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
So, Colibri, maybe for listeners that are unfamiliar, maybe you could just give a brief background of who you are, and then we'll get into your latest blog entry, sort of opinion editorial. I found it on Counterpunch. It's called The Teachable Moment of the Greta Thunberg Phenomena. We'll talk about that, but I want to give listeners a little bit of background on yourself first.
Right. Well, I used to be an organic farmer for about 10 years when I lived in the Portland, Oregon area. I was also an activist in that area with indie media back in the early 2000s. The last 5 years, I've mostly been traveling around the West Coast and, living out of a truck and making my spending money working on the cannabis farms in Northern California. And so I have a lot of interest in environmental issues. I have a lot of interest in issues of media and corporate media and interest in all sorts of leftist politics in general.
I didn't realize that you were involved in indie media. That was sort of a thing, in my like early years and when I was a teenager. And it's interesting. I like yearn for the days of indie media now that we're living in this like moment of Facebook and Twitter and, you know, just being bombarded with advertisements no matter where you go.
Oh, I absolutely definitely agree with you. I mean, indie media was a really amazing resource for about 5 years there, you know? And, you know, when a big, you know, say a big protest happened in your town or whatever, you could go to your indie media that day and watch as reports came in from different people, you know, typing up, oh, here's what I saw, here's some pictures, you know, oh, the newspaper said there was only 500 people there, but we know there was at least 1500. Oh, here's what the cops did. You know, here's what they said they did. Here's what they really did to us. I mean, and there's nowhere to go for that anymore. I mean, now an event happens and there's no place that's collating all of the information from the witnesses because, you know, yeah, people put up a picture on Facebook or whatever. Oh, hey, I was at this march or whatever, but then it's just gone. And like, you can't even find it a few hours later. I mean, there's not really been a replacement for indie media. And in some ways, I think that alternative media on the internet kind of peaked in the early 2000s and that we've been losing since then, actually.
Well, not to go off into too much of a tangent about it, but the thing I notice is there's so many people that are sort of, they're involved online. You know, there's this whole term, the online left. And I'm like, I've always said to people, I'm like, you know, you can watch as many YouTube videos as you want doing takedowns of right-wingers or talking about environmental issues, but it doesn't replace real activism. I think there's a real disconnect there. I think people think the internet can do much more than it actually can in terms of real-world impacts.
I definitely agree with you, and I think that, you know, if you look back at, you know, say a classically successful campaign, like for example the Birmingham campaign of the early 60s, you know, when they were like Martin Luther King was involved in that, and the Southern Leadership Christian Conference, and a lot of other activists, where they were trying to put down segregation in that town. You know, that was a whole bunch of people who were getting together in person, you know. A lot of them through their churches and then through other organizations. And then what were they doing? They were boycotting stores. They were doing sit-ins, you know, in businesses and in churches, you know, and then they were doing marches, you know. And then what finally got the nation's attention to Birmingham was when there was news footage that went out of the white cops using fire hoses against the black protesters, including the children, you know. So all the organizing was done, you know, in person for the most part, you know, and then all the actions were like on the street, very physical actions, you know, and that's partly why that campaign succeeded. I actually wrote about that campaign a little bit in my most recent book, Road Tripping at the End of the World.
Well, out of curiosity, just to give slightly a little bit more background, how did you get involved in activism and maybe what was your sort of political awakening?
Right. Well, I was raised by Catholic Democrats, and so sort of had an anti-war sentiment there from the very beginning, but didn't become politically active until Seattle was what did it for me, the WTO in December, late November, early December of 1999. And at that point, actually, I was just working at a temp job out on the East Coast somewhere, and I saw the news report starting to come in from the uprising that was happening on the streets there. And I was like, oh my gosh, it's finally here. It's finally happening. I'd sort of been waiting years for something to happen, you know? And so, you know, a few months later, I'd quit my job and I'd broken up with the relationship I was in. And I was living in Minneapolis and I was involved with Twin Cities Indie Media there, which I helped start there. And then with the Ralph Nader campaign, you know? And so I was like, became kind of a full-time activist at that point, and remained a full-time activist through about 2005, 2006 or so, mostly with Indie Media, but also still with a lot of Green Party activists. And I lived in Portland for a lot of that time too. And like, I worked at the local food co-op or whatever. Then I became a farmer starting in 2006, first as an urban farmer and then as a farmer out further, you know, as we're doing organic farming. But it was Seattle that was really the moment of inspiration, because that was like, that caught the ruling class by surprise too. Every once in a while, the elites are caught by surprise, and they got caught off balance at that point. And actually the negotiations in the hall there did not go the way that the U.S. and the other colonial powers wanted it to go, because the people from the global South who were in there took, you know, inspiration from what was going on in the streets and were like, okay, now wait a minute. We don't actually want to just go along with what you want. And so that was an amazing moment. And, you know, you may or may not remember that the sort of spark that went then like became a bigger and bigger fire, you know, through all of 2000 into 2001. And then boom, September 11th was like, kind of like, you know, didn't squash it completely, but really, really tamped it down in the United States, because people were afraid to protest for a while right after that, you know?
Yeah, well, I was going to say, for my younger listeners that may be unfamiliar, you're referring to the Seattle protests against basically globalization. And, you know,
that's right.
Yeah. I mean, it's, although I think the kind of anti-globalization protests that you and I are talking about are very different than these, you know, sort of right-wing Tucker Carlson type characters who now use the term like globalism and whatnot. I think the original anti-globalization movement,
it's
still ongoing, was actually a very admirable thing.
It definitely was, and it was a global movement that was really based outside of the United States, was drawing its energy from outside of the United States, and then happened to express itself in the United States through the protests against the WTO in Seattle. And then, you know, later protests against the World Bank, the IMF, et cetera. Like, there was protests in Canada later. You know, there was a whole set of them that happened at that point. But it was a global movement, and sort of the unofficial rallying cry was, you know, otro mundo es posible, you know, another world is possible. And that was that wasn't a right-wing sentiment at all. These were very much, you know, this is the Zapatistas were involved, and like indigenous people from all over the world were also involved with this, you know. So it was the kind of energy that I would say that the kind of sentiments that the United States isn't even really capable of producing at this point. That kind of energy would have to be coming from somewhere else already at that point. I mean, because the U.S. has been in decline now for a while, and so all of the energy here is kind of in decline, including the energy of resistance.
Well, I would just add that I guess, summing it up, the anti-globalization protests of the 90s, I think they were energized by a desire to stop the exploitation of the global South, you know, because the
Absolutely.
IMF, World Bank, that's what they were doing. It was the West
Right.
exploiting the rest.
Right. Right. And then with like NAFTA, for example, is where the elites were then bringing it to the United States to exploit workers in the United States as well, you know? And you know, Ross Perot ran for president as an independent in 92, I think, you know, maybe 96, I can't remember, but, you know, saying that this would be bad for American workers, you know, and he was correct. After NAFTA passed, that is when a lot of manufacturing left, you know, and manufacturing jobs then left the United States. And, you know, that's also when there was a an acceleration in the wealth gap in the United States. And of course, that was all done under a Democrat, Bill Clinton, you know, which tells you what you need to know about the system, too.
Yeah, I always tell people, you know, the Democrats are America's center-right party. The Republicans are just the far-right party.
Right, right. And they're a little bit further right every year, you know, since the 80s, really.
Well, I guess since we sort of laid the groundwork there, we're going to talk about Greta Thunberg. But maybe first, there's one more thing I should ask you, and that's how did you become sort of environmentally aware? You said you did farming for a while. Maybe we could talk a little bit about how you became sort of green conscious.
Well, I think the first inspiration that I had, well, I moved to Portland, Oregon in early 2001. And there I happened to be living across the street from the Cascadia Forest Alliance. And so that was a group of it was like an Earth First outgrowth. And what they were doing was they were involved with tree sitting campaigns in that time, because there was because of some legislation that Clinton had passed, there was a lot of old growth forest that was in danger of being cut in the Pacific Northwest at that time. And so there were a lot of tree sits going on. And so through indie media, because I went out there as an indie media activist, I immediately got involved with these forest activists too. And so I got brought out to the forest, and I would go out there and go to one of their action camps. I'd stay a few days. I actually got to go up into a couple of tree sits, which was an amazing experience. And so through those activists, I really was just amazingly inspired by the beauty of the forest, the beauty of the old growth, you know, trees. And then also equally inspired by just the immense, you know, sadness, you know, and fury that comes from looking at these places that have been all chopped down. You know what I mean? I mean, especially seeing someplace before and after is a very powerful experience, you know. And so that was, and, you know, those are tree sitters are at the, you know, coming out of the Earth First thing. I mean, they're just this side of the monkey wrenchers. You know what I mean? Like it's a nonviolent civil disobedience, you know, but it is illegal, obviously, you know? So those people really, really kind of brought me into being an enthusiastic, an environmentalist. And then later I became interested in the farming, in the organic farming, simply because of a lifelong interest in healthy food. But then also because of Katrina, which happened in 2005, the hurricane which hit New Orleans, because you'll recall that, you know, this massive hurricane hits New Orleans, you know, all this flooding and you know, the sort of conventional ways that people would take care of themselves, you know, grocery stores and all this, like none of that wasn't really, you know, the hospitals, none of that was really working very well for a while. So there was a lot of organizers, some of whom I knew from Portland, and including anarchists, who went to New Orleans after Katrina and were helping out with the community-based, neighborhood-based solutions that were going on, where it was like, oh, how can we help each other? You know, like the federal government isn't helping, the Red Cross isn't really helping, you know, the local government isn't really helping. And so, you know, having local support networks in place to take care of each other in times of crisis. And so I thought, well, you know, food growing needs to be part of that. So at that point, 2006, I became an urban farmer in Portland and did that for a few years there with the idea that, like, well, there'll be more and more crises going on as time goes on, you know, because of peak oil and climate change and whatever. And so we need to relocalize our food networks. And like, you can't get any more local than actually just growing the food right there in the city, you know? So that's kind of where I took that one.
Well, you know, it's curious because we're in this moment now where more and more people are talking about climate change and climate change activism. I remember, you know, if you were in support of climate change activism at one point, you know, people would just say, oh, crazy tree huggers. Now it's like a becoming a mainstream thing. I mean, even if you're critical of things like the Green New Deal or some of the things around Greta Thunberg, it's interesting seeing the sort of cultural shift. I mean, as far as I understand, the Green New Deal originally originated with, you know, the Green Party. I've heard Howie Hawkins, who's now running as a candidate for the Green Party, he's talked about that. I mean, it was a Green Party thing originally, and now it's become this mainstream thing that, that Democrats like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez are pushing.
It was super fringy at one point, and now it is definitely becoming all the issues around climate change are definitely becoming better known. And if you look at the United States in comparison to other countries, there's the number of people who, you know, believe it here is still lower than basically anywhere in Europe, for example, you know, or other countries where their media is not as controlled as ours is here, you know, or in other places like Bangladesh, where they're simply feeling the effects of it and seeing the effects of it more severely than we are here now. Because, you know, really in the United States, people are only, you know, they're seeing the more extreme weather events, you know, the droughts and the fires and the flooding and the, you know, they're seeing these things. And like some people are like, but when those things happen, the number of people believing in climate change tends to go up, you know. But we're still not facing crises here like we are in, like, say, Bangladesh, where you know, their freshwater supply is being inundated by salt, you know, and so they're having more trouble finding drinking water. They're having more trouble actually watering their crops. Like their challenge is much more existential there than it is here.
Well, I was going to add to that. I think one of the reasons it's been ignored for so long in America is I think race plays an element in it, in the sense that the people that will be affected by climate change first are people in, you know, impoverished areas of the world that, you know, America just looks the other way when it comes to those countries.
Right.
And, you know, that's what climate justice has always been about, pointing out the fact that, you know, this ties into the system of exploitation we see globally.
Yeah, it totally does. And of course, the, you know, what ties right into that then too is the militarism of the United States as well, because that system of certain people being kept down and the United States elevated is accomplished, you know, two ways: economically, you know, through the economic power of the United States and the dollar as the reserve currency, and then through the military of the U.S. And, you know, the United States is the only country that has ever, you know, used nuclear weapons against civilian populations, for example, and everyone else remembers this, even if we forget it here, you know?
Well, I guess moving forward a little bit, now that we see climate change sort of taking on a more mainstream position within our discourse in America and globally, this op-ed, The Teachable Moment of the Greta Thunberg Phenomena, which sort of, I would say, it complements what the left-wing investigative journalist Corey Morningstar has written with The Manufacturing of Greta Thunberg for Consent, a very provocative piece that she wrote. There's sort of a moment of questioning going on with Greta Thunberg right now. Maybe you could explain, why do you think the left maybe should question this phenomena a bit?
Just the phenomena around her popularity, period, or?
Around her popularity, and maybe then after we get through that, we can talk a little bit about the Green New Deal and maybe some of the pitfalls of it.
Right. I mean, you know, I think that you know, Corey Morningstar did really very impressive work in her six-part series showing all the different connections between, you know, the funders, you know, the, you know, there's all these grant giving organizations, you know, how much elite money is involved in setting up different environmental organizations, and how some of those are involved with Greta or with her family, or she's involved with them, or there's attachments or whatever. I mean, there's all of that is like, all of that's really factual that got pointed out there. All those connections did, and you know, her work's super impressive, you know? Now how much of that comes down to the grassroots level is another question. For example, I have a friend who was involved with 350.org in Portland, Oregon. And 350 is one of the organizations that Morningstar discusses. And 350 was started by Bill McKibben, you know? And they get lots of grant money that's, you know, that's pretty dirty from all these places. And 350's official stances, you know, are, you know, maybe fairly conservative or something like that. But, you know, at the local level, the 350, you know, in Portland, 350 PDX, you know, was able to make its own, you know, decisions and make its own choices, and was definitely to the left of the national organization, and was not getting like a bunch of pressure or something like that to change, you know? So I think that just because all these, just because they're all these monetary connections exist and all this funding exists, doesn't mean that everyone's being controlled right down to the local level. There's still people who are independent at the local level. There's people in local 350s, local Sierra clubs, local whatever, who are involved in their own local campaigns, who are for real, who are not just having their strings pulled from further up, you know?
Yeah, well, in a way, I think that that may apply to Greta Thunberg in a way itself, because I think there's a lot of I've seen a lot of people on the right just completely question her sincerity, and I get the impression that she's actually very sincere. At the same time, however, you know, I've had some people say in response to right wingers, well, you know, maybe you should try creating your own global movement like Greta did. And, you know, I have a slight issue with that in the sense that I like Greta Thunberg, right? But
right.
The idea that she was able to do this all on her own, just in, as an individual, that it's completely off base. I mean, she comes from a celebrity family that has the social capital to get her name out there. And as sincere right. as she may be, there are people that are just not listened to when it comes to climate change. I think it's great that she's getting the word out there, but I mean, even at the base level, I mean, she has a type of social and cultural capital that most of us don't have, and therefore we're not listened to. And I'm not faulting Thunberg for that. I'm just saying I think her ability to move through what the sociologist Pierre Bourdieu called the field of power is much greater than a lot of our own.
Oh, that's undeniable. Absolutely. I mean, she is herself as an individual within all of this. How sincere is she? Well, that's something that to one degree or another, we just can't know, you know? The fact that someone is personally inspired and, you know, even personally inspired to do something, for example, by seeing her speak or hearing her words, well, now that's another thing. And the actions of people who are inspired by her to do things are not all going to be under control of that social network, and aren't all going to be moving within that social network. I mean, all the kids who you know, who did take to the streets after she visited here. I mean, you know, that was, you know, hundreds of thousands of people in the United States. I mean, that's kind of a big deal. Like, you know, just getting hundreds of thousands of people out on the street, you know, has some value all by itself. And I don't want to overplay that value either of marching, because that only has a limited value as well, but it's not nothing, you know? And I think that just as the elites are like taking advantage of and trying to take advantage of Greta, you know, by putting her out there, well, grassroots activists can also try to take advantage of that as well. That's the other side of it, is that, well, now that she's out there, now that she has brought people's attention to certain issues, now that she said these certain things, well, that's also something that we can attempt to take. We can attempt to take that energy and to steer it different places as well, you know?
Well, I guess if we could back up here a bit, Corey Morningstar's work on this, it revolves around largely around NGOs.
Right.
You know, and I guess for listeners that may not be as questioning of this, why do you think that maybe it's good to question these NGOs? Maybe it's good to question things like, you know, green capitalism. Oh, we can just have a green capitalism that will fix all of this.
I mean, the idea of green capitalism is just completely ridiculous. That's just not even, I think that that's not possible. That's super, super wishful thinking is what that is, because capitalism itself is just inherently exploitive, you know?
Well, it's also based inherently on endless growth. I don't know how you can
absolutely
have, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. And growth is what actually needs to stop, you know? The whole idea of a growing economy as being a good thing, we actually need to turn that one on its head and be like, no, actually, at this point, we should all be having a contest as to who can shrink their economy, and we should all be proud of how much less we're using now than we were like a year ago or something like that. Because, of course, that's the, you know, I mean, not to jump ahead or anything like that, but that's kind of at the heart of what people don't want to face when it comes to dealing with not only climate change, but all the other environmental issues that have to do with pollution and stuff like that, which is just that we have to be producing less. We have to be consuming less. We just have to be doing less at this point in general.
Well, I guess the other, to play devil's advocate, you know, I guess sure. People would say, well, if powerful people are now talking about climate change, how can that be a bad thing? It has to be a net good, because the more people we have talking about it, the better, right? I mean, how would you sort of respond to that?
Well, I think that to some degree that is true, yes. I don't think that just because powerful NGOs are bringing up climate change, you know, that isn't a bad thing. What they're trying to do is control the narrative, and what they're trying to do is control where the resources are going to go. They want to control how people are thinking about this, and then where they're going to steer it, you know, like that's what they're trying to do. And so they're very smart to sort of be trying, they're trying to get out ahead of it. You know what I mean? So like they're being smart by doing that, you know, and obviously, climate change is a real thing, you know? And you look at the news, the corporate media in the United States, and they never want to talk about climate change. They just never, ever want to talk about it. So the fact that, you know, that this young lady from Sweden comes over here and now they're willing to talk about it for like 2 minutes. Well, okay, that's better. That's 2 minutes that we didn't get before. It's just that we just have to understand that that in itself is not enough. You know, that only takes us so far. And that the amount of time we want to spend celebrating the fact that, you know, the elite are talking about this and that the media is talking about this. And we just don't want to spend too much time celebrating that. We can be like, okay, that was great. Next, move on. What can we do with this now? You know, I mean, it's not enough. It's only a starting point.
I think a lot of times just the way people talk about climate change in general, or how to deal with environmental issues, it boggles my mind. I mean, you know, I remember when everyone was saying, oh, well, you know, you can help by, you know, taking shorter showers and reusing your towels. And I'm like, yeah, there's lifestyle things we can do. But ultimately, you know, if you have a municipal golf course down the street, that uses more water in the day than any of us. And it's just, I think the lifestyleism aspect of some environmental talk is it doesn't get to the core of the problem.
Yeah, and I want to stress this exactly, that when I say we need to consume less and produce less and all that, I'm using that we in the broadest general sense possible of, like, you know, the human race, not, you know, we as in, you know, consumers in the United States or something like that. Because, you know, I mean, you mentioned water and golf courses, and that's a great one, because, you know, in the United States, you know, according to I remember reading this in one of Derek Jensen's books, you know, 90% of the fresh water in the United States is used for industry and industrial agriculture. And then of the 10% that remains, half is used by like people in their houses, and the other half is used by golf courses. So if you know, everyone stops taking showers, stops washing dishes, stops watering their lawn, and actually just stops drinking water, that would only be a 5% reduction in water use, which wouldn't matter. It doesn't even, that doesn't even make a dent. Like, that's still within the margin of error, so to speak, you know? So when I say we in that sense, it's like, well, we need to look at the whole thing and be like, well, where is that water going, you know? Should we be watering these enormous almond orchards in the Central Valley in California when a lot of those almonds aren't even being grown for food here? They're being grown for export, you know? Look at all the water that's going into being used for fracking. Look at all the water that's used in industrial processes like, you know, manufacturing, you know, circuit boards and that. I mean, that's the kind of thing we need to look at. And, well, look at all the water that's going into agriculture that that's being used to raise animal feed. And it's not even directly for people. I mean, it's a tremendous amount of water, you know?
Well, so that maybe that lifestyleism, that may be part of the narrative that has been pushed in the past. What do you think the narrative that is being pushed now by elites is? Like, what do you think they're trying to control here and shape in regards to how we think about climate change?
Right. Well, it seems like, I mean, it's always a little bit tricky because here's what they're, you know, what are they presenting? What's behind that that's really going on? I mean, you can start to get into a lot of second guessing that can kind of turn into a clusterfuck. But I mean, it seems like basically there's an attempt here to, as you said, you know, and as they've been saying, to green capitalism, to like basically keep the status quo as close as it is to possible, you know, and just change whatever they need to change within that. So like, how can they keep making money? And if it's not going to be about fossil fuels and it's going to be about this, how can they control those resources? I mean, there's powerful people who just want to stay in their powerful positions. So what do they need to do that, you know? And I don't know. I mean, I suppose one could be cynical and think that, well, maybe they see that what's going on and they just don't care. And they just want to, like, you know, make as much money as they can and whatever on the way out. You know what I mean?
I guess the thing that sticks out about this is, you know, when it comes to this idea of green capitalism, it just seems like it's not exactly it's just not a fix for it. I mean, I don't know what the plan is necessarily, but it just seems like something to make us feel better before the inevitable happens.
Yeah, I think that's definitely just part of it. Yeah, it's just to make us feel better, and then part of it is just that they want to stay. Yeah, I mean they just want to stay on top of their hill, you know.
Well, I mean, we've talked a little bit about the maybe issues with regards to the Greta Thunberg phenomena, but you're also you're not cynical about Greta Thunberg either. Maybe we could talk a little bit about that.
About not being overly cynical of her, you mean, or
not being overly cynical? I mean, one of the things you say is that. So when we listen to Thunberg's words, we must guard ourselves against both naivety and cynicism. Both prevent a clear perspective.
Yeah, that was sort of the heart of the whole article there. It was nice of you to pull that one out. Yeah, I mean, because basically the people who are just like, you know, oh, this is so great. She's such a hero. You know, look at this, you know, that she's over here getting all this attention. It's like, well, you know, just celebrating her. And not being like, huh, the corporate media doesn't like to talk about climate change, but they're completely willing to talk about it now. Like, I mean, there has to be some people need to look clearly at that and be like, well, okay, now wait a minute. Why is she getting to be in the news? You know what I mean? Why is it an important issue now? You know? And then, but at the same time, not just being like, everything about her is complete bullshit. Everything she says, well, that's just not true either. You know? I mean, it's like people have the glass half full, glass half empty, you know, thing where there's the people who that's just the world for them, you know, is that they're always finding hope in everything. And then there's the people who are always finding hopelessness in everything, you know, and you don't have to subscribe to either of those. You don't have to subscribe to either a hopeful point of view or a hopeless point of view, but rather you can go for something else, which is an attitude which is free of hope. So you're neither being hopeful nor hopeless, but merely trying to see things for what they are. And in the United States and in Western culture in general, we have a tendency to dichotomize everything and put it into one side or the other. And so most people feel that they have to look at it. They're being hopeful or hopeless. But as I said there, neither of those is good if you actually just want to see it for what it is.
Well, is there anything you think particularly is getting lost in the shuffle? I feel like the biggest problem with the Thunberg phenomena, and I think it's great, as you have said in your article, that she's inspired people and moved people's spirits to look at the issue of climate change more. But when it just becomes a thing where, oh, right-wingers are attacking this young girl, and, you know, the left-wingers, they bite back, or, you know, or where she just becomes sort of a meme that people share on social media, what gets lost in the shuffle of that when we turn an activist into a celebrity, essentially, is we lose sight of the issues. And I think there's a lot of issues that just people don't want to touch when it comes to climate change. I mean, you mentioned militarism. That's one of the biggest ones.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's been mentioned, that she hasn't brought up anything, that Thunberg hasn't brought anything up about, you know, militarism. Or if she had, it hasn't been central to what she's talked about at all. That's been a big criticism of her from the left. I've kind of looked at the things that she's said, and I've noticed that she hasn't been very specific, period. She's mostly had a very general message of things are messed up. You know, I'm too young to do anything about it. You know, my generation is too young to do something about it. You people are in charge. You need to do something about this. But that's been her basic thrust. So in that she hasn't mentioned really any specifics at all, it seems unfair to me to like say, here's a specific thing she didn't mention. So it's like, well, but she's not even getting into that, you know? But yeah, the militarism, I mean, so that's where people, you know, where the activists can then come in and be like, oh, that's great. She's drawing attention to this. Okay, now let's put some meat on these bones, so to speak. You know what I mean? How can we take this attention now that she's put out there and like, you know, give it something?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I've seen some people on the left go really hard on Greta Thunberg in a way that I'm uncomfortable with. You know, people saying, oh, she's the new face of neocolonialism, or the new face of neoliberalism is the one I see a lot.
Right.
But when
right.
she said, quote, we can't save the world by playing by the rules, because the rules have to be changed. Everything needs to change, and it has to start today. And when she says endless growth is a fairy tale, she's on record as saying that.
I know, right?
I don't think that's something neoliberals like very much.
No, and that's not a green capitalism. That's not a green capitalism precept or concept either. You know, I mean, that was I really liked that particular quote. You know, the one you just listed there. I liked that one was like, okay, that's not what you'd call a radical critique per se, but it's like, that's not pro-capitalist. Calling endless growth a fairy tale, it's not pro-cap. No, I'm sorry, that's not pro-capitalist.
Not to interrupt you, but her exact words were.
Yeah.
People are suffering, people are dying, entire ecosystems
right.
are collapsing. We are in the beginning of a mass extinction. And then she adds, and all you can talk about is money and fairy tales of eternal economic growth. And she says, how
right.
dare you? I mean, I think that's,
right.
you know, that's pretty badass in its own way.
I thought so. I thought that was totally kick-ass. And like, you know, I mean, who brings up the fact that entire ecosystems are dying? It just doesn't happen very often. People don't want to hear about that. You know what I mean? Who wants to hear about the fact that extinctions are happening? I mean, if you're talking about trying to market, responses to climate change, those are not words to market anything with. I mean, that's not marketing language. I think that's really her right there, you know? That's her speaking, you know, that's her speaking her truth, and those are true things that she's saying there. And I realize that there are, you know, people on the left who are just going to take her apart every single way that they can. And I just, I'm personally, I'm not a leftist in that way because I'm not personally hopeless.
Yeah. The other criticism I hear from a lot of people on the left is that, you know, people are only listening to her because she's young, she's white, she's a girl. She sort of hits all these criteria where you can't attack her. And to me, I'm like, it's not her fault that she is white. She is being listened to because of these things, but I can't really fault her for that personally.
Well, yeah. And, you know, I mean, people need to take it. I mean, isn't if those are all things that are sort of pointing to privilege that she has, you know what I mean? Like her class, her color, you know, et cetera. Well, isn't she now attempting to do something right with that privilege? I mean, if you're in a position of privilege, don't you have a responsibility? I mean, some people would say this, you have a responsibility to use that privilege. Well, I don't know. Isn't she doing that? I mean, that's one answer to that.
Well, maybe out of curiosity, what you mentioned that this goes both ways. The elites can take advantage of things, but the people at the grassroots can too. What do you think is the sort of good, the, as you put it, teachable moment that can come out of the Greta Thunberg phenomena that is still occurring as we speak?
It is still occurring. I think that, well, there's a lot of different teachable moments in this teachable moment. One of them is looking at the reactions, you know, is seeing an illustration of this dichotomized, you know, worldview of like, oh, she sucks versus, oh, she's a saint. You know what I mean? And being like, well, neither of those can possibly be true. You know? So that's one thing. It's to observe it as a social phenomenon and to see that. And then, and to look at oneself then and be like, ah, how can I steer clear of being in either of those camps? And how can I see it clearly? So that's part of the teachable moment. Another part of it is the fact that yes, the media, you always have to question what the media is presenting to you and why. Like the media has inherent biases, not just in what it will cover, but in how it will cover it and in the scope of how things are covered, you know? And so there's a teachable moment there too of like, yeah, Corey Morningstar is right that this person's being pushed forward. And yes, Corey Morningstar is right that like, and other people are right that the mass media is comfortable holding her up and putting the spotlight on her because of certain characteristics that she has. So yes, that's all good to see how media works, because media, the corporate media, which now I'm including not just broadcast media, but I'm also including like the social media and how they work with their algorithms, and say a search engine like Google, and how it's deciding what you're going to see. All of this media has become more and more sophisticated over the course of the last 20 years in how it's able to shape perception and how subtle it can be, and how it involves people, and how it involves people, and how it draws people into it. So, I mean, we always have to be really we have to be keeping a really close eye on what corporate media is doing and how it's doing it, because they don't have our best interest at heart. They simply don't.
Yeah, it's interesting. I recently graduated from university. I took some years off university, then went back to finish out my degree, but in one of my classes, we were talking about media, and I said, you know, everyone thinks our media is so free, but, you know, really we have, you know, a few major corporations with their own interests at heart in charge of, you know, the vast majority of media in our country. And someone said to me, well, I've been to Cuba, and Cuba is so suppressive, and yada, yada, yada. And I just said to them, I'm like, have you ever read Cuban newspapers? They don't say anything that is that much different than the U.S. I mean, when it comes to like basic news stories, and I'm like, you know, people are so afraid of government and state subsidized media, but when it comes to corporate media, there's no questioning, and I just find it very bizarre.
Absolutely. I mean, and it's, you know, like about a half a dozen corporations that control something like 90% of the media in the United States. And that's like TV, radio stations, and newspapers, you know. And so, and there's an increasing number of people in the corporate media too, who are intelligence agencies, you know, either past or present. I mean, NPR, the new person in charge of NPR, I don't know if you call them president or what you call them, but is they pulled from Radio America, from the, you know, which is the propaganda arm of the government overseas, you know, because everyone knows the United States like puts out media, you know, overseas to try to convince, you know, oh, here's what the United States is, here's what we're about, here's our spin on the issues, you know. So they took that person who's in charge of U.S. propaganda and put them in charge of NPR. This just happened recently. So that kind of thing is happening on now too, where they're really, they're really getting it locked down tight. I mean, when Clinton did the Telecommunications Act in the, what, 96, I believe it was, he's the one who really opened it up for the media concentration that was illegal before. Before that, you could only own X many newspapers or radio stations or television stations in a market. And then that took that away so that it could be unlimited. That's when the concentration, you know, happened. And now, you know, and then at the end of the Obama administration, one of the last things that he did, which did not get enough attention, was he, I don't know if he got rid of something that had been there before or he put something new in place. I can't remember the details of that. But it had been technically illegal for the United States to propagandize the U.S. public directly, like through the media. But he took that away. He did that after the election, by the way. So knowing that Trump would come in, I mean, it was just, anyone who thinks Obama is a good guy just needs to look at that kind of thing, you know? So we already know that the government was propagandizing the U.S. population through the media, but now it's like just open. Now they're just allowed to do it. And, you know, everyone needs to read, you know, Manufacturing Consent by Chomsky and Herman. You know, everyone needs to like understand how these things work and know that if you are reading the New York Times every day and you think you know what's going on in the world, that, you know, you're delusional. There's so many things that they will never talk about. And then the things that they will talk about, they'll only talk about in certain ways.
Well, I mean, just at a basic level, I mean, I've had people say, you know, oh, if you're criticizing the New York Times, you're saying, oh, it's all a conspiracy of fake news. And I'm like, not really. I just think, the type of people that work for the New York Times that own places like the Washington Post, they have their own material interests at stake. So therefore, they Absolutely. May not talk about something that affects their bottom line.
Yeah. Yeah. And media also, you know, is constantly changing. And media is different now than it was, you know, 50 years ago or almost 50 years ago when, you know, Watergate happened. You know, that was a different media that existed then than exists now, you know. And, you know, Christopher Hedges, he wrote that book, Empire of Illusion. And he had a chapter in there about corporate media. And he talks about how the people who run corporate media, who run the Times, who end up running, you know, the big news organizations, you know, that they all come from the elite schools. They all come from the same set of elite schools that a lot of the people that go and run, you know, other corporations do, you know. And so the view of the world that's given to people through these elite schools Hedges went to one of them. He has a degree in divinity from Harvard, right? So he understands this from the inside out. And he worked at the New York Times for 20 years. He was fired for anti-war views that he expressed at a commencement ceremony in like 2002 or something like that. But he was a foreign correspondent for the Times for like 15 years or something. So he saw the system on the inside and was like, yeah, these are all people who are part of the same class of wealth and privilege. And so what's important to them is not what's important to everyone else. And well, they're only going to report.
I was just going to say, mm-hmm. They're also, by nature of their wealth and their privilege, they're removed from, you know, the problems
yeah.
of people. So, I mean, you know, I think that's why you have a lot of people at the New York Times or the Post who sort of take these technocratic views. Like, I know the problems. I've played by all the rules. And, you know, I went to the elite institutions, so I know how things work. It's not about politics. It's about you know, getting things right through the right equations and this sort of logic is everything right. mentality. But they're removed from the situations of the everyday person. And I'm not, that's not necessarily their fault. They're sort of inside a bubble. So they're blinded in that way.
They're definitely inside a bubble, and they're more inside a bubble now than they were in the past. That's just one thing that's changed, that's gradually changed over time, that not everyone's been aware of. But, you know, the beat reporter who like hangs out at the working class bar, you know, with the iron worker, you know what I mean? And the off duty cop or whatever, you know, like that just doesn't happen like that anymore. You know, like reporters aren't hanging out with working class people anymore the way that they used to.
It's
now
not like,
they're much more interested.
I was just going to say, it's not like when, you know, someone like Hunter S. Thompson was writing, you know,
right.
a whole expose of the time he hung out with the Hell's Angels, you know, those days
right.
are long gone.
Yeah. Yeah, no, those days are totally long gone. I mean, and they, it's become a more professionalized profession, you know? And we also can't forget that at the same time as there's been all this concentration, the number of people working in media has also just like plummeted, you know? The number of newspaper jobs has gone down, what is it, something like 40% in the last 20 years? Well, you can't lose four out of 10 reporters and not have that change things. I mean, you know, how many, you know, even when I was, you know, growing up, I remember there were a lot of towns that still had, you know, at least two newspapers, you know, and there used to be more than that. You know, now every town really only has one major newspaper. I mean, every city. And then you get down to the level of smaller towns and they're losing them. I mean, there's not the infrastructure there anymore that there once was. You don't have as many people reporting news, you know, and so and of the people who are, they're more likely to be of a higher class, of a more privileged class.
Well, I was
they're not talking
to
their garbage man.
What was that?
I said, you know, they're not talking to their garbage man. You know, I mean, you know, they're more likely to have a nanny. You know what I mean? Than they were before. You know.
Oh, definitely. I mean, I think the flip side to that. And I know we're going off into a little bit of a tangent, but I think the flip side to that is, you know, I see a lot of younger journalists who, you know, are downwardly mobile. They're becoming much more radical. I mean, you know, 10 years ago, I wouldn't have imagined, you know, freelance writers who write for places like, you know, Teen Vogue, writing articles in Teen Vogue about the history of anarchism and why anarchism is a good thing. I think there's a lot of journalists that are starting to feel the heat. The ones not within the sort of beltway establishment
right.
that are, you know, becoming radicalized because of what's happened to journalism over the past decade.
Right. Yeah. No, I've been impressed by Teen Vogue too, actually. Yeah. And I think that there's a slow but sure radicalization of the younger people and the youth happening anyway. So of course that's going to be reflected in the work that they're doing, you know. I mean, I don't know. You said I don't know how old you are. I was born in 69, so I'm Gen X.
I'm 28.
And my
I was
generation
born in 91.
Ah, right. Yeah. Okay. That was yeah. I graduated from college. So are you what they call a millennial then?
Yes.
Yeah. You're a millennial. Okay. So I mean your generation, the millennials are more open-minded and more radical in basically any way that you can think of. Than Gen Xers are. And Gen Xers, we were more radical and open-minded than the baby boomers, you know, before us, you know? And so now, you know, I look at the, you know, I love hanging out with the people who are younger than me and hearing what they have to say and seeing what they're doing, you know, and the ideas that they're bouncing around because it's much more interesting than anything that my generation is doing. And we don't even need to say anything about the baby boomers. I mean, they're just a bunch of boring, you know, whatever. So they just need to get out of the way at this point, you know?
Right. Well, you know, it's interesting when I talk to Gen Z kids at my university, I always tell them, I'm like, man, you guys got screwed by, you know, a lot of the other generations, particularly boomers, I don't like going down the generational politics rabbit hole too much, but you know, ultimately, like you know, millennials and Gen Z are, you know, kind of stuck in downward mobility. I mean, there's not a lot of prospects left.
Oh, absolutely. Those generations all just got shafted, and they know that they got shafted. And the biggest problem that my generation has is that enough of the people in my generation did make it, quote, make it, and were able to get the good job and get the house in the suburbs and whatever. Enough of us made it that it held us back from becoming more radicalized. You know, we did have some contributions, like, gay rights really moved forward a lot. With the Gen X, you know, generation for sure. You know what I mean? Like there was a few issues, you know, like that. But like as far as I'm concerned, the baby boomers need to get the hell out of the way right now. And as soon as they do, then the Gen Xers need to get out of the way too. As soon as it's within our power to do so, we need to step aside. And I wrote an essay about that a few years ago too, where you might look up and enjoy. That was also on Counterpunch.
Well, you know, before you go, I guess I wanted to talk a little bit about the Green New Deal, because I think it ties into this wider phenomena of, you know, not just Greta Thunberg, but also talking more about climate change and it getting within the discourse more. I know Corey Morningstar is very, very critical of AOC. I sort of have more optimism for AOC. I'm, you know, hoping that she's not just another Obama, you know, hope and change, but not really. Case, what do you think about AOC and the Green New Deal, though? And maybe I'm being too optimistic about it. I don't know.
Well, I think it's great that AOC is there, and I don't by any means think that she's perfect or whatever. I'm not seeking that in any politician either. I haven't been critical of her at all in anything that I've written, because I just don't feel like I don't feel like it's worth it. I think that the good that she's bringing in within that context of the U.S. Congress, the good that she's bringing in, okay, that's fine. I'm not going to get on her about anything, because what she's bringing in is so fresh compared to everything else that's in there. I mean, look at Nancy Pelosi. You know what I mean? Like, people, you know, there's a classic example of who needs to get out of the way for people like AOC. I would love to see a Congress where AOC was at the rightward end of it. You know what I mean? Where she was like sort of as conservative as it got. That would be great, you know? And I read her, when she put the Green New Deal with the actual legislation out there, which was, I think really it was just a legislation to start a committee that would look into all these things. I read it top to bottom, and I was like, okay, like, this is obviously better than what we're doing now, you know, and I'm glad that she's putting it out here, because this will help move the discussion in that direction, because the discussion needs to move in that direction. And then it needs to move much further than that, because the original, you know, Green New Deal, you know, that Hallie Hawkins has talked about was definitely better than the one that the Democrats, you know, are putting forward. I mean, it does not go far enough. The fact that it doesn't go far enough doesn't mean that it just sucks and we shouldn't talk about it. It's like, well, if that's going to move a tent stake over in that direction and help draw some people over that way, then that's good, you know, as far as I'm concerned. And I actually wrote to AOC. I hadn't written anybody in Congress in maybe 20 years. But I actually wrote her before that, just to make one point, which was that, okay, if there's going to be more installation of renewable energy in the country, solar, you know, wind, et cetera, like that, it's extremely important that the environmental impacts of those be taken into account as well. Namely, it's not a good idea to go out and put in these huge solar farms in the middle of the desert. Because it's not that the desert is empty. The desert is its own ecosystem. There's all sorts of plants there. There's all sorts of animals there. A lot of them, a lot of these areas are less disturbed and more pristine than other areas in the United States, because they couldn't be farmed. No one wanted to live there. I mean, these are areas that have been left alone for the most part. So now to go into these areas and destroy them, well, no, that doesn't work. And so I wrote her a letter about you know, about that, because that's still a point that's not made enough, you know, by anyone who's talking about renewable energy. You know, they, you see these pictures of the big solar farms and the big wind farms is not the way to, it's not the way to do it. The industrial size energy plants doesn't work.
Well, you know, it's interesting. You mentioned, you would like to see a Congress where AOC is like the most conservative end. It's odd to me. You know, people always say that an AOC or a Bernie Sanders, they're the radicals. They're too radical. And it's so bizarre to me because, you know, people say that the centrist Democrats are for incremental change. In my view, actually, it's AOC and people like Bernie that are for some type of incremental change. I mean, they're just asking for the bare minimum. You know, I mean, it's so topsy-turvy now that we think the establishment Democrats are left-wing. They're as right-wing as you can get. Specifically on issues related to economics. And yet, you know,
oh, absolutely.
I mean, 40 years ago, these people wouldn't have been considered left-wing at all. No one would think that. It's bizarre how much, you know, times have changed. I mean, to me, Bernie is just a sort of new version of FDR. I don't see how that's that radical. I mean, just in the span of what, you know, since the 80s, everything has gone, you know, upside down. Our ideas of what is left and right are completely topsy-turvy.
I totally agree. That's absolutely the way that it has gone, you know. And, you know, Bernie is not anti-war, you know, for that reason. I don't support him, you know. And when it comes to the economic system, well, no, he doesn't want to change away from capitalism. He just wants to make it a nicer capitalism, kind of like FDR had. And so, yeah, Bernie, again, he would have to be at the very far right of a spectrum that's actually going to get something done. And I remember seeing this happening, what you're talking about with everything getting more conservative. I mean, when Reagan was elected, it was clear that something had happened, you know, right then, and that something was over, you know, because growing up in the 70s, there was still like, there was still this feeling that was left over and this energy that was left over from the 60s of like change and of experimentation and of openness and of like sort of being adventurous in different ways. And you could just feel that being squashed as soon as Reagan came in. And it's just been worse. Since Reagan, basically every president has been worse than the one before, right up to the current moment.
Well, I want to add to that. It's interesting. I have a lot of contempt for the Reagan-Thatcher axis that sort of brought neoliberalism into full swing. But what's fascinating to me is I think today's neoliberals would say that Thatcher and Reagan weren't harsh enough. You know, I think that today's neoliberals want to go for broke when it comes to just wiping out any social safety nets, any kind of welfare. I think they're even more extreme than Reagan Thatcher, which is, you know, that's saying something. It's kind of scary.
Oh, they definitely are. I mean, you know, it's been joked that Monica Lewinsky saved Social Security because Clinton was going to go after Social Security next. He'd already like dismantled the social safety net to such a large degree, you know, with getting rid of so many of the entitlements, you know, and he was going to go after Social Security next. And then the impeachment proceedings happened. And so he had to drop that. He wasn't able to get anything done, you know. And then Obama also wanted to do greater cuts to Social Security than were passed. But the Republicans in Congress hated him so much that they wouldn't go along with his plan, even though it was going further than they were asking for. He was actually trying to cut Social Security more than the Republican legislation. And it's just them being some stupid partisans that they weren't able to see that and just go along with it. Because, yeah, Clinton and Obama were just horrific. You know, both of them were. And so was Bush, and so was Trump. And so was, I mean, they've all been terrible. You know, they've all been taking everything apart as fast as they can. They've all been terrible for the environment, and they've all been, you know, they've all been imperialists, you know?
Well, just two more things here. I guess the first thing is, you know, someone was complaining recently about how the left criticizes corporations too much. And I sort of rolled my eyes. But what they said was, You know, if you say corporations are evil, then corporations will be evil because saying that normalizes them being evil. And I'm just like, I don't even know what that means. I don't even think it's necessarily that every CEO wakes up and is like, rubbing their hands, thinking, oh, I'm going to do something evil today. It's just, like I said, they have their own interests. I think evil has very little to do with it. I think the outcomes are often very evil, but I just don't understand this push by centrist Democrats to say, you can't criticize this, this, and that. Maybe it's a sign that they're up against the wall finally. I don't know.
Yeah, it could be. I mean, well, the fact that they even have to say something about it shows that the topic has come up, you know, shows that it's gained enough momentum. And for that, perhaps one could thank Occupy, because the whole 99% thing, I mean, Occupy was good for just introducing that concept to the mainstream of politics. Like, everyone knows what's meant by the 99% and the 1%, you know? And most of the people in the 99%, they understand that they're there, and they understand that the people above them are trying to screw them over. I mean, this is just really obvious to most people in the United States. And this is, you know, I mean, you know, Bernie Sanders, his platform, you know, of the different things that he's asking for, you know, socially, et cetera, all have widespread mainstream support. Not only among Democrats, but also among Republicans. I mean, his views are actually represent the mainstream views of the United States. And the Democrats and the Republicans are both far to the right of the population.
Well, you know, it reminds me, another thing I saw on social media was, it was one of these sort of like, I think it was a Biden supporter maybe, but they were going on, because there's so many people on Twitter now that will just go on tirades about their hatred of anyone who supports Bernie Sanders. And they were saying, they were doing the clapping emoji and saying, single payer healthcare will never happen. Say it with me now, is what they posted. And I was thinking to myself, why are you like, what person in their right mind cheers on the idea that we can't have single payer? I mean, I find it bizarre that we live in a country, and I know I'm ranting a little bit, but I find it bizarre that we live in a country where, there's people that can't even afford health care. I mean, even with things like dental care, you know, which is not really covered under the ACA. And you know, dental care has major impacts on people's prospects. We've seen that in study after study. People can't afford these things, and yet we're told, well, just can't have that. It blows my mind.
I mean, it's mind blowing. Yeah. And as for what we see online, it's also important to remember that not everything that we're seeing is actually a real person either, you know, in terms of some of them are actually bots. You know, they're getting better and better with artificial intelligence of being able to have bots out there, which are contributing, which are sending out tweets or doing those things. And there's people who are just hired too, you know, to sit in rooms, you know, that this is their job. They're hired, because Hillary hired some people like this, I know, and I'm sure the other side did too. I just remember reading about it with Hillary in 2016, where, you know, they hire people to go into discussions and to say certain things, you know, and to make it look like regular people, you know, believe these things. You know, the corporations, you know, do this as well. And so online, you don't know if the person you're arguing with actually believes those things, or if they're simply being paid to say those things, or if they're not even actually a human. We haven't had to deal with that before. I mean, we've never had to deal with that before. That's brand new. Like in the 90s, that wasn't happening. This is new in the last 10 to 15 years. To have to deal with, like, oh, am I even having a discussion with a real person? I mean, if you had described the world we live in now to people in like the 80s or the 90s, they would have been like, what kind of strange dystopian science fiction Philip K. Dick world are you describing here? I mean,
have you ever seen those? Have you heard of deep fakes yet? They're videos. There's this technology called deep fake video technology. Where you can actually, people would have to look it up. I'm not exaggerating this at all. you can basically CGI a person's face onto anyone, and it will look exactly like them. And it's a real technology.
Wow.
And I'm like, this could have horrifying ramifications.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I believe it. Like, the place they've gotten with technology is amazing. I mean, you know, you've seen in the movies how they're able to make actors look 20 years, you know, 30 years younger than they actually are. And it's convincing for the most part, you know?
I guess the other thing I would mention is, since we were talking about environmentalism, the two things that bother me with, I wouldn't say they're leftist approaches to environmentalism is one, you have elements of the far right now pushing sort of this weird eco-fascism. And then you also have centrists, I think, who are really just sort of in favor of an anthropocentric view of climate change. Like, well, you know, the gorillas can die. The polar bears can die. This climate change is really only about us.
There are definitely people who are like that. I mean, and it's incredibly short-sighted and incredibly unrealistic. I mean, obviously, you know, if the honeybees die, we go with them. You know what I mean? Like, we have to think about everything else in the world and all the other creatures. I mean, you know, when it comes to, say, population, for example, like, there's the people who say, oh, there's too many people in the world. And then there's the people who say, no, that's a racist white view of people who just want, who don't like the fact that brown people are reproducing too much. And we can definitely support more. We can definitely support all the people that are here. It's just about, you know, consumption levels are too high. And I'm like, wow, have those people gone outside of the cities and looked at what's happening in the world? You know, and this is why I wrote this recent book together about road tripping at the end of the world, because it's like, it's become clear to me that people who live in the cities have no idea the immense effects that our lifestyles are having on the environment. You know, like the fact that there's really almost no wilderness that's untouched by pollution, you know, at this point, you know, the fact that like, you know, all these natural ecosystems have been completely destroyed in order to have agriculture there. It's like, no, we can't have more people because there'll be nothing left. You know, I mean, when it comes to mammals on the earth, I saw the Guardian showed this, did an infographic that said of the mammals on the earth, if you just by sheer weight, 36% of the mammals in the world are human, 4% are wild animals, and 60% are cattle. You know, it's like, well, no, that doesn't work. that doesn't work. And you know, those things have to change. And we have to think about all of the other creatures on the planet in order to get ourselves into a decent situation.
Well, that's why I brought up the other aspect of, I see more and more, and they're admittedly fringe right now, but sort of fringe right wingers trying to take up environmentalism, and they actually often talk about the overpopulation issue. But I think it's done in this very, and I'm hoping you would disagree with this sort of view of overpopulation, but the sort of Malthusian sort of view where it's like the, you know, the poor just shouldn't be allowed to breed. They're the problem. That's sort of, there is an actual racist interpretation of overpopulation.
Oh, there definitely is. Yeah, there definitely is. And like, there was a eugenics movement in the early 20th century that was real, you know, in the United States, which led to the Nazi movement and, you know, which inspired the Nazis. You know, I mean, there were, you know, people in the United States who were forcibly sterilized. I mean, it's true that, you know, some of the money that originally started Planned Parenthood was started by people who were into eugenics. Now, that doesn't mean that Planned Parenthood sucks. Planned Parenthood has a bunch of important services, you know, that it provides to different women. You know what I mean? Like, you know, and so I get that. I think that you know, there is that racist view of that, but we don't have to look at it that way, you know. And have you heard of Ryan Wildermuth?
No, I'm not familiar. Tell me a little bit more.
He's perhaps I could describe him as, yes, he calls himself an anarchist. He's an anarchist, and he he has he works for he's an editor of a publication called Gods and Radicals. So he's a pretty well known anarchist in the anarchist community.
You know what,
he was
I recently
writing.
You're talking about. I'm sorry. I had Ali Valkyrie from Gods and Radicals on a while back. The name just slipped my mind for a second.
Yeah, they're friends. Yeah, they're totally friends. So he just recently wrote about ecofascism, actually, too. And he said, we've become justifiably worried about groups like Todd Boys and lone wolf murderers, but in our panics focused on them, we miss the totalitarian apparatuses arising to wreak even more horror on people groups. This goes especially for the new panic about ecofascism. Focusing on fringe white national groups who cite the environment in their hatred of immigrants and brown people obscures the larger totalitarian trap closing around us. I've mentioned this a myriad of times already, but Trump's border wall is the ultimate eco-fascism. As the climate collapses, people in the global south will need to find food and water. They'll go north, but there will be a wall blocking them in detention camps if they somehow make it past. European controls against immigration are similar, as are some, quote, socialist plans to transition to, quote, green energy by placing nuclear, wind, and solar plants in poor, heavily minority areas to, quote, save the earth. That's the eco-fascism none of the urban progressives, with their Vice and Salon anti-fascist think pieces will ever address. So he really addresses well what you were saying there, that if you're looking to look at eco-fascism, we need to look at the larger powers that are moving here, the Proud Boys are just not, they're not a big deal. They're not a growing movement. They're a bunch of loud assholes who are on their way out, you know, because the younger generations aren't racist like that anymore. Not to that degree, you know, their days are numbered.
Well, I was going to add to that. It is interesting that as the climate crisis looms, you know, this is the point where, you know, right wingers start pushing for a border wall. You know, isn't that, I mean, it seems rather, well, I guess it comes off as very coincidental, but one wonders, as, you know, the sort of war over resources happens, I think you're going to see a lot more right wingers saying, well, we need to build a wall because, you know, the climate refugees will come in if we don't.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that they'll have some, you know, mainstream, you know, support for that too. But, you know, we just have to make sure that remains a fringe view, that does not become a socially acceptable way of looking at things, and that we're trying to address these issues in ways, you know, well, as you had said before, climate justice, so that there aren't these issues with the people are suffering in other places, you know, and we just do also have to be ready to take some people in here. I mean, ultimately, that's going to happen. As the climate gets worse, there will be places that people just can't live anymore. And yeah, we're going to have to make some room, you know, make some room here. That's just what we're going to have to do. And eventually that'll happen whether or not we want it to, you know what I mean? So, we should be welcoming it and figuring out how to make it work for everybody, you know, from now on. You know, as they're talking about the border wall, we need to be talking about, well, what's our real solution here, you know?
Well, I always like to end on a positive note. Any positive vibes you can give out to my listeners, and also if you want to plug your website and where people can read more of your writing.
Right. Well, if people would like to see more of my writing, they can go to my blog, which is maxgamoksha.com. That's MacSkamoksha.com, maxgamoksha.com. Maybe you can have that written out somewhere when you post it. And you can find me on Facebook, of course, you know, too. And I've written a number of books in the last few years that I've self-published, and I have a blog there as well. And I try to put out a new piece every week. And as for a positive message, I would say that returning to Greta Thunberg too, is that I am definitely encouraged myself when I see the youth and the things that they're talking about and the things that they're doing and their energy. And I am hoping that the youth can take a charge and can start steering things as soon as possible. And whatever it is that I can do to support the youth, and however it is that I can help them, I will be happy to do as this comes about. And I really think that if the youth are allowed to lead, that there is a chance of us getting out of this conundrum without everyone dying and all the ecosystems dying.
Well, Colibri, I want to thank you again for coming on Parallax Views.
Well, that does it for this edition of Parallax Views. I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Colibri Ter Sonnenblom, author of Road Tripping at the End of the World. What's your take on the Greta Thunberg phenomena and the trajectory of climate change activism today? Let me know by dropping me a line on Twitter at ViewsParallax or by email at parallaxviewspod@protonmail.com. Also, if you're a fan of the show, please consider supporting me on Patreon, where I release bonus content like the Parallax Views The Week That Was current events program and a few raw video versions of the conversations from the Parallax Views main show. Your support is what will keep Parallax Views alive and thriving. And with that being said, until next time, you've been listening to Parallax Views with Parallax Views. To Parallax Views with Parallax Views.
The way out is not simply to say don't do it, just to prohibit. It's nothing else. If we don't do it, others will be doing it like crazy. So, you know, we have to confront the problem. But no, basically, I know of the great anxiety problems, new forms of control, but it's also new forms of freedom. This is why I always emphasize that internet and all this new digital stuff, it's a very ambiguous phenomenon, but it's the field of struggle. New forms of enslavement, but at the same time, new incredible forms of freedom. We have to accept the fight with no nostalgia for old, allegedly more authentic communities or whatever. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid.